Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Hampton Sides, author of On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In October of 1950, General Douglas MacArthur assured President Truman that the end of the Korean War was in sight and that American soldiers would be home by Christmas. In fact, 300,000 Chinese soldiers were secretly crossing the Manchurian border and setting a trap for some 20,000 U.S. Marines along the frozen shores of the Chosin Reservoir. In this encore edition of Reader's Corner, we talk with Hampton Sides about his newest book, On Desperate Ground. In the book, Sides offers a vivid account of that brutal battle at Chosin Reservoir. Facing probable annihilation and the worst Korean winter on record, with temperatures dipping to 20 below zero, the story of the Chosin Few, as they came to be known, is one of incredible fortitude, ingenuity, and courage. Hampton Sides is an award-winning author, journalist, and historian. He is an editor for Outside Magazine and has written for The New Yorker, Esquire, Washington Post. His previous books include the best-selling histories Hellhound on His Trail, Blood and Thunder, and Ghost Soldiers. Hampton Sides, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be back with you. Thanks.
So this hit home for me, Hampton. I was a kid when this war was going on, and we had a neighbor who was a dear friend, and her son went off and never came back. And for years, we would visit her and see his picture there. So going through your book, you know, I'm looking at all of these casualties, just thinking about where he would have wound up. I have no idea and didn't get any specifics, but it was clearly a difficult encounter from the top down to the grunts who were over there serving. I wonder maybe if you could start just by giving us a thumbnail sketch of the Korean War in terms of its impact. How many Americans we lost, the time frame of the war. I mentioned the number of Chinese that came over the border, the North Koreans that were involved. If you could just give us a little bit of a history here.
Sure, kind of a Korean War 101, and necessary because so many of us don't know that story. It is called the Forgotten War because I think for a variety of reasons, we weren't taught about it in school. It didn't really penetrate the public psyche and consciousness in the way that World War II did or even Vietnam War did. It's kind of an asterisk or an also ran that's sort of sandwiched between these two other wars. And so consequently, the public just doesn't quite know what to make of this war. It was a war that was often called a police action by Truman originally, sometimes just called a conflict. But believe me, it was a war. It was a devastating war. And it was in many respects a world war that was fought in a very localized piece of real estate, the Korean Peninsula. The reason it all happened, just to kind of do it quickly, is that right after World War II, the Allied powers were forced to figure out what to do with the spoils of the Japanese Empire. And, of course, Korea had been a colony of Japan. The Japanese had brutally mistreated the Koreans, but it was their colony. So what to do with Korea? We wanted to turn it into a democracy and a capitalistic state. And, of course, Stalin had other ideas. He wanted, we have to remember, Stalin was our ally briefly during World War II, at least. And he wanted Korea as well. And no one could really figure out what to do about that. So a line was drawn temporarily at 38th parallel, which more or less divides the country in half. And, you know, it should never have been divided at all. It was one country, it was one people, it was one culture, one language, but it was divided. That was supposed to be temporary, but very quickly North Korea became modeled after Stalin, and Kim, the grandfather of the current leader of North Korea, was installed, and his army, Soviet-trained, Soviet-equipped army, grew in power. Whereas in South Korea was sort of modeled after us, a capitalistic democracy, or on the way to becoming a democracy. It is, of course, now a democracy. And then in June of 1950, Kim Il-sung and his Soviet army stormed across that 38th parallel, wanting to unite all of Korea under communist rule. And Kim was very much a communist. I mean, he had trained under Stalin, and he had fought with communists against the Japanese during World War II. His army was quite successful. They took Seoul in 3 days. They were marching all the way down to the southern tip of the peninsula. We got involved to shore up the South Korean army, which was very weak. Other forces got involved from other United Nations countries. But then in September of 1950, MacArthur had this idea of sort of doing a in run around the backside of Korea, going in at a place called Incheon, huge amphibious landing there, and to sort of retake Seoul, cut off Kim's supply lines. All of this was actually spectacularly successful. The North Korean army began to evaporate, you know, into the hills, and it seemed like the war was over in October of 1950. But MacArthur got a little bit greedy, you know, this is kind of a classic story of hubris and overreach, in which MacArthur, you know, he just said, well, let's don't just destroy the North Korean army. Let's reunite all of Korea under South Korean rule. Let's go all the way to Pyongyang. Let's go all the way to the Yalu River and make it ours. Of course, the Chinese took a dim view of this. They didn't want a democratic, capitalistic society right on their doorstep. Some have pointed out that if the Chinese had made an amphibious landing in Mexico and had marched all the way to the Rio Grande border of Texas, what would we have done?
Right.
Anyway, the Chinese decided. Mao had just won his civil war against Chiang Kai-shek, and he was anxious to kind of flex his muscles on the world stage and show his influence in the region. So he decided to intervene in huge numbers. Hundreds of thousands of troops were sent to Manchuria and began to cross the Yalu River to envelop the American forces as they were rushing headlong to the Yalu. So that's kind of a Korean War 101. It would have been a short war of only a few months had the Chinese not intervened and had this not become a much more complicated and much scarier world, kind of world war. It ended up lasting for 3 years. And we lost over 33,000 men in Korea, and millions of civilians were killed on both sides of the 38th parallel. I don't know how many Chinese in the end were killed, but many, many tens of thousands of Chinese. And, of course, forces from all over the UN nations, everyone from Great Britain to New Zealand, Australia, Colombia, Turkey. You know, this was truly a world war that was kind of fought in this crammed down into this one peninsula, this scrap of land. And it was really kind of the first frightening opening salvo of the Cold War.
And while we're on the subject of the Cold War and the World War, the possibility of a Third World War, and there were many thinking this may be the beginning of that, Truman comes into Japan to meet with MacArthur. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that particular encounter. And somewhere along the line, I think I read in your book, where MacArthur actually proposed nuclear weaponry in dealing with North Korea to get them really out of the way.
Yes, well, Truman wanted to meet with MacArthur. There was much talk about where that meeting would take place. It didn't actually end up taking place in Japan. They met on this little speck of an island, Wake Island, traveled many thousands of miles, both of them, to meet there. It's kind of a strange meeting in a lot of ways. It was the only time these two men ever actually met and ever would meet. It's not absolutely sure why Truman flew so far to meet with MacArthur, but he did want to obtain some sort of assurance from him that the Chinese weren't going to intervene. And MacArthur said, no, they're not going to intervene. And even if they did, they're really no threat. He said, they're just a peasant army. They're just a bunch of guerrillas, you know, fighting a very crude kind of war. And don't worry about them. They're not a threat. We'll slaughter them. And the war will be over by Christmas. Well, you know, the kind of classic example of asymmetrical warfare, I guess you'd say. The Chinese were a peasant army, but they were a seasoned army. They fought in a very different way. They were not mechanized. They were really skilled at camouflage and eluding detection from the air. They only moved at night. They only fought at night. They didn't build fires or anything that could be spotted from the air. They slept during the day in caves and wherever they could hide. But they had the sort of the element of surprise and the flexibility of movement because they didn't adhere to the roads. They didn't need roads because they didn't have vehicles of any sort. They were a foot army. And so they traveled over the mountains and were able to surround and envelop the American forces as they were marching north and kind of coax them further and further into this trap up in the mountains of North Korea.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Hampton Sides, author of On Desperate Ground. So I remember when Truman fired MacArthur. I was a little kid, as I said earlier, but my parents, I can remember vividly, were in the living room reading the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And it was a huge headline across the front of the paper. Of course, they were Truman Democrats, and so they thought that anything Truman did was okay. And I think history will record that it was okay, that it was the right thing to do. One of Truman's great quotes is, "I didn't fire him because he was a dumb SOB, although he was. I fired him because he wouldn't respect the authority of the president." And, of course, that's quoted in your book as well.
Yeah.
What role did MacArthur's mishaps in planning out this war have to do with that firing, or were there other things that were going on by the time he got fired?
Well, there were a lot of different factors. You asked earlier about his wanting to use nuclear weapons, MacArthur, and he did. You know, he called for it privately, he called for it publicly, and he wanted to drop a bomb on Beijing. He wanted to sow what he called a permanent radioactive zone along the Yalu River that we thought would keep the Chinese out for 100,000 years. It was kind of crazy, Dr. Strangelove kind of thinking and talking back then about nuclear weapons. And it was pretty clear that Truman didn't really want to be the guy who dropped two bombs on Japan and then went on to drop more on China. Truman did not want to escalate this war into a true world war. He did not think that there was a political will in this country for another full-on world war over the ideology of capitalism versus communism. It was something he wanted to keep as regional as possible. And he had a lot of different, you know, differences of style, differences of personality with MacArthur. They couldn't be more different. MacArthur was brilliant, but he was always the first to admit it. You know, he was real arrogant. He was old school guy. And, you know, I don't think ever in our history had we concentrated so much power, military power in one commander as we had with MacArthur by 1950. Because he was running the occupation of Japan. Effectively, he was the emperor. He was in charge of all the UN forces in Korea. He was in charge of the Army of the Far East, and he was the supreme commander of all operations in the Korean War, and all of which might have been fine if he had been on the ground. But he ran this war from Tokyo. He never slept a single night on Korean soil. He left it to his field commanders to run the war, but he didn't ever really listen to them. And it's not like they weren't capturing Chinese soldiers in skirmishes and you know, the field commanders were beginning to realize there's Chinese here, lots of them. They're all around us. But for some reason, MacArthur didn't want to believe it. So he ultimately ended up presiding over one of the great intelligence failures in American military history by somehow not wanting to believe this on-the-ground intelligence. And, you know, he ultimately got in trouble with Truman about, you know, he just started making all these kinds of independent pronouncements that really were under the purview of the presidency. You know, like he was acting like a president and making all sorts of policy pronouncements that were at direct odds with what Truman believed. So Truman ultimately had no choice but to fire him. You know, he forgot somewhere along the line, MacArthur forgot that Truman really was the commander in chief.
And there's a great management lesson here as well. As you point out, he was surrounded by yes men. They were all sycophants who were really just there to tell him what they knew he wanted to hear. But let me move right on to your subtitle. Why is the reservoir, the battle at the reservoir, the Korean War's greatest battle?
Well, you know, I use the word greatest in all of its senses. It was a big battle. It was an epic battle. It was a battle that involved not just the two main combatants, the Chinese and the Americans, but the terrain, which was so extreme, and the weather. It was 35 below zero at times. It was this all-suffusing presence that really affected every twist and turn of the battle. And because it was such an extreme set of circumstances, including the overwhelming numbers of the Chinese, it became this, you know, really desperate battle for survival, survival from the cold, survival from these waves after waves of the Chinese who descended upon the Marines. It really brought to the fore this survival instinct and this camaraderie that is just fierce and ferocious. And for that reason, it is one of the most decorated battles in American history. Just all these examples of incredible courage and resilience out on this battlefield, which was spread out over many miles along the shores of this frozen lake. It's also a great battle in the sense that there's really some just huge personalities involved in it, from Mao and Stalin and MacArthur and Truman, down to the field commanders, people like Chesty Puller, the probably the most famous Marine there ever was, and the real hero of the book, who is the commanding general of the 1st Marine Division, a guy named Oliver Prince Smith. General Smith is really an underrated general and a guy who saw this battle coming weeks in advance, had begun to take a lot of precautions to protect the lives of his division. He's a guy who's revered by the Marines and, you know, just I found the guy fascinating. And so for all these reasons, it's a great battle. It's a great sort of set piece and a kind of a story that has a lot of, I felt like, kind of classical qualities, you know, almost like
right.
Something you'd read out of Herodotus or Thucydides.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Hannibal marching in the mountains with his elephants. There's something about these men marching into this trap because of MacArthur and other poor intelligence, and then having to regroup, figure out how to bash their way out of this trap and march back down the road to the sea where they would regroup. And at the end of this, there's a huge evacuation, massive evacuation on the level of Dunkirk. So it's just epic and big and I say great in just about every sense of the word.
Well, as far as General Oliver Prince Smith is concerned, I was so impressed with your treatment of him that I did my own research and found that his daughter wrote his biography, and I think there were a couple of others out there. I mean, this guy, if the Marines ever had the role model Marine, it's Oliver Prince Smith. He's something yeah. else. And the other thing I thought your book was so good at was highlighting some famous firsts. The first Chinese-American Marine officer, the first African-American aviator in Korea, and the heroism around this. I mean, I came to tears two or three times in your book reading what these guys did. And I want you to tell the story of Thomas Kudner and Jesse Brown. Again, we've got to do it briefly, but I just think there has to be a little addressed in this brief conversation we have about the extraordinary courage, as you've pointed out, that we see coming from these draftees or in some cases officers.
Yeah. Well, you know, once the battle actually begins, it very quickly becomes a story of all these little individual profiles in courage. And the Hudner Brown story is a perfect example of one. Jesse Brown was the first African-American aviator flying in the Navy, flying planes off of aircraft carriers. And he was flying over the Chosin Reservoir during the battle. His plane was shot down, and he had to crash into the mountainside, and his plane erupted in flames. He was trapped in the plane. He couldn't get out, and his wingman and friend, Thomas Hudner, a guy from a very different background from Brown. Hudner was from a very wealthy family in the Boston area, New Englander, kind of an officer and a gentleman. And, you know, he's circling overhead. He sees his buddy's plane erupting in flames. He realizes he's trapped down there. So he decides, Hudner does, to violate Navy protocol, to do something dramatic, which is to deliberately crash his own plane into that mountainside, to crawl out, to you know, risk his own life to try to save his friend. And he knows he's going to get court-martialed for this because the Navy expressly says you don't crash another plane to save the first plane. You just don't. It's just a waste of machinery. And as heroic as it sounds, it's just not something that you do. Well, he did it anyway, and he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for it. Unfortunately, in the end, Jesse Brown did not survive, but it's a great story of friendship and, you know, never leaving your comrade behind. You know, that's a story at this, on this in so many battles, but particularly the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. You see it all over the battlefield.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Hampton Sides, author of On Desperate Ground. In the book, Sides offers a vivid account of the infamous Korean War battle at Chosin Reservoir. You mentioned the evacuation at the end of the book. You discuss in detail how Oliver Prince Smith came up with a plan to get back to the coast and get out of this situation where they're being overrun by Chinese-American troops. And there's an engineering feat here that I thought was very fascinating. This isn't all about guns and ammo, but also about some brain power involved here. Could you describe that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, the story of the Chosin Reservoir is peculiarly an engineering story. The engineers play a big role in ways large and small because of the terrain and so forth. And the first thing they do is they decide to build an airfield up in the middle of nowhere where no airfield would be, really. Smith knew he needed to be able to bring in huge transport planes because he knew there was going to be a big battle. And he also knew that he was going to need to evacuate large numbers of the wounded casualties. And over 4,000 casualties were flown out from this airfield that was built by the engineers under the most difficult circumstances. You know, imagine you're on a bulldozer or a piece of grading equipment. You're driving it, but you're also, you got a weapon. You're actively fighting a battle while trying to claw out this this airfield from frozen terrain. So that's one of the stories of the engineers. Later in the exodus out of those mountains, the Chinese blow a bridge at a place called Funchilin Pass. It's a very precarious place, and it plunges over 1,000 feet down. And the Chinese blew this bridge, and the American engineers had to figure out how to build a bridge in a matter of hours because there was 13,000 Marines who were trying to march out of there. And all their vehicles, their tanks, their jeeps, their trucks, all their artillery. And so the Marines figure out a way to, with a kind of a network of parachutes, how to drop these giant steel girders from an airplane you know, drop them in this particular place where they could be protected, and there was a perimeter, and then they carefully moved these girders to the bridge site and built this bridge while fighting a big battle and got this thing built in a matter of hours with a lot of improvisation. This was not a by-the-book kind of thing. This was seat of the pants, just, you know, trying to figure out something that would work, but they did make it work. And all the 13,000 Marines came across on that bridge, and as soon as they did, the engineers blew it up because they didn't want the Chinese to use it. So it's just another one of the many stories, these sort of set pieces within this battle that just kind of blew me away. And I do think that uniquely, this was a story of engineers and ingenuity and improvisation. Because when you're trapped in a situation like this, in an ordeal like this, you know, you'll do anything to get out of it.
I'd love to know how West Point teaches what I learned, thanks to your book, about the Korean War and military leadership in particular. And while there are these great examples of people like General Oliver Prince Smith, there's also examples of people like General Ned Almond. And I think it's only fair to share at least as much about failed military leadership as it is the successes that somebody like Oliver Prince Smith had. And boy, I mean, this guy's thinking was seemed way off base, but you take it from there.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly Ned Almond, General Edward Almond, does not come across very well in my book. He was the right-hand man of General MacArthur. And so a lot of his faults are really MacArthur's faults. He was doing what he thought MacArthur wanted him to do. And I ultimately, you know, what do they say, a fish rots from the head down, right? I mean, that's it's really MacArthur's fault. But Ned Ullman was a classic yes man. He knew how to sort of read the signals and figure out what MacArthur wanted to hear. He was also a bit of a racist. He didn't believe that blacks should be fighting. He thought they were sort of piss poor soldiers, and he didn't like the fact that there were Puerto Ricans fighting in this battle. And, you know, he was always talking about how bad the Chinese are. He seemed to be kind of racist about the enemy. He said, they're just a bother. They're just a bunch of laundrymen. You know, keep marching. And he was just tone deaf to the battlefield realities. And his attitude was just go, go, go. March as fast as you can. And they would say that with Ned Ullman, they would say, when it paid to be aggressive, Ned Ullman was aggressive. When it paid to be cautious, Ned Ullman was aggressive. He was always aggressive. And that kind of attitude may be good in a field commander or a lower level person, you know, at the regiment level or the battalion level. But when you're the overseeing general, he was the general of the 10th Corps, which is a huge group of men, about 75,000. It becomes a different proposition. He was full of hubris and full of arrogance and really has a lot of blood on his hands, I think, by virtue of putting these men, so many of them, in harm's way when they didn't need to and ignoring a lot of intelligence. So, yeah, that's Ned Ullman. I hope they teach him at West Point, but I don't know if they do. They may just decide it's a little too uncomfortable of a story for the Army.
One of the things, and I think this is the last question we have time for, but one of the things that comes clear in your book is how so many of these Marines who are wounded seriously fight their way back to continue the war. I mean, we haven't had a chance to touch on the heroics. So many people's names who I'd like to mention, of course, almost all of them have passed by now, but you did such a marvelous job. Could you comment on that? I mean, like Fox Company, where they were outnumbered 10 to 1. I mean, the heroics is just unimaginable to me.
Yeah. Well, certainly it was one of the great joys and the great reward of doing this book was getting to know some of these guys, interviewing them. A lot of them have passed away even since I met with them. People like Hector Cafferata, who was one of the Fox Company guys. You just mentioned Fox Company, Fox Hill. They're stoic. They're tough. They've been to hell and back. They know it. They're proud of having been in this battle and having acquitted themselves well and having gotten out of this ordeal. Many of them suffered frostbite and lost fingers and toes and parts of their face and ended up retiring in places like Florida, as you can imagine. I actually interviewed a number of guys in Idaho for this book, but most of the guys seem to gravitate to warm weather places in their retirement because they just could not deal with the cold. But they're very proud, but they're also a little mystified and a little resentful, I think, that their story isn't better known. They're both the story of the battle and the story of the whole war. It's a forgotten war. It's a war that people just don't seem to think about as much except for endless reruns of MASH. You know, it's like, what was Korea again? Why were we there? What was that about? And they're probably going to, you know, go to their grave with this kind of feeling of puzzlement, like all the things that we did over there and those exploits and the sacrifice and the bloodshed and the heartache. Why isn't it better known? It's one of those mysteries that certainly I wrote the book in part to try to correct. I think what they did was amazing. And I think that they are heroes every bit as much as their older brothers and cousins from World War II were heroes. So that's really why I wrote it.
Well, you succeeded in the most exciting and touching way, believe me. You helped us remember Hampton, and it allows us all to pay tribute to those who served in the Korean War. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, On Desperate Ground by Hampton Sides, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle. Thanks, Hampton.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our program. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.